Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. Well, we had quite a weekend in which, for the first time, the Islamic Republic of Iran directly and massively attacked Israel. It did so in a way that involved, by some estimates, some 300 missiles of various types. Fortuitously, providentially, I would say, very few of them got through the various defensive measures that were in place and that were brought to bear, including not only those of Israel, but some of ours, the American militaries, as well as that of some Brits and even the Jordanians. And as a result, there was not much death and destruction, but not because it wasn't the intent, but because of those measures. The question is, are those measures going to be available and effective in the future, especially if the Iranian regime goes unpunished for what it has just done? To explore all of this and much more, I am proud to present once again a man that we have been consulting with intensively ever since October 7th in particular, but have been a friend of and a greatly admiring colleague of as well, namely Dr. David Wormser, to get his sense of the momentousness of what has just happened and what is ahead. He is the director of our Middle East program at the Center for Security Policy. You can follow his work there at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. And more to the point, you can support that work, which I strongly encourage you to do. All of, I think, our research and analysis and our partnerships and other activities merit your financial largesse, but especially at a time such as this, the work that David Wormser is doing, the incredible expertise that he brings to bear, having served at the highest levels of the United States government, support of an undersecretary of state, a national security advisor, and even a vice president of the United States, this work is indispensable, and we need your help in making it happen. David, small commercial message aside, let me say heartfelt welcome. Thank you so much for joining us once again. And
thank you.
What I know was a full-on weekend of work that you put in trying to monitor what was going on. Tell us what you take away from what was your experiences.
Well, first, I think that the technical aspect, I mean, Iran launched 110 ballistic missiles, 36 cruise missiles, 185 suicide drones at once. It's the largest ballistic attack, I believe, that we know of at this point in history. What I'm hearing is also that about half of the launches didn't work. They either exploded on platform or in very first stages and fell back to earth in Iran, about 50%. So we're
Do
really
you think there's any chance that that was a function of interference?
No, I think it was most likely a function of the quality of their systems. So 150,000 pounds of ordnance was launched onto Israel. That was the warhead capacity, potentially as high as 300,000. Of those, the United States and allies, the UK, Jordan, Saudi Arabia admits it, participated, France participated. They shot down 75 projectiles, mostly drones, a few, three missiles, cruise missiles. Israel shot down the rest, seven using, the big thing was they shot down, of the 110 ballistic missiles, they shot them all down at exo-atmospherically, except for seven, which were heading to areas that weren't important, or five, or actually three penetrated and hit the air base at Nevatim, down in the south, one of the main Israeli air bases, and knocked out a runway for, or at least one runway for a few hours, and damaged a C-130 transport aircraft, minor damage essentially. that was repaired immediately, and there are other runways there. So essentially, as far as casualties, there are no Israeli casualties except for one 10-year-old girl, a Bedouin Arab girl. They live in an illegal, unpermitted village, and therefore didn't have any shelter, and shrapnel from one of the missiles fell on her. And she is still in critical condition, but expected to live at this point. It's the only Israeli casualty. So
Israel, David, we were told, and let me just make sure I understand what you've said and ask you to elaborate. We've been told that the Iranians opted only to target military assets, facilities, installations, what have you. Is that your understanding? I mean, this collateral damage thing was different, obviously, but that was not the case?
No, they targeted Jerusalem. They sent missiles onto Jerusalem. There were missiles heading toward critical sites in Jerusalem, including the parliament. Were they accurate enough to hit the parliament? I don't know, but certainly there were a lot of missiles headed to Jerusalem. There were 30 missiles headed to Dimona, Israel's nuclear reactor, which meant they attempted to create a Chernobyl disaster. So this was not a limited operation. This was not a small operation. This wasn't symbolic. This was a devastating attempt, or an attempt at a devastating strike at Israel. Whatever the expectation of the West was beforehand, this was larger and more deadly in theory than what we had thought it would be.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about what we thought it would be and the extent to which the Biden administration seems, from what I've seen, to have had some foreknowledge of what was taking place here or going to take place here. And for example, they, I understand, warned American citizens to go to the cities, including Jerusalem by name, on the basis of what, I'm not sure, but presumably some insight into what was going to be targeted. And that's why I wanted to draw you out on this question. They did in fact send missiles. Some even said they were capable of attacking and destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque, said to be one of the holiest sites on the earth for Muslims.
There was certainly a lot of stuff overhead on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. There's videos of it, of the battles in the atmosphere between missiles and Israeli anti-missile missiles and so forth, shrapnel falling all over the place.
Do you think it's fair to say that Israeli defenses may have prevented some of that from falling on the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
I think it certainly is possible. I think it's quite possible. These were headed to Jerusalem. We can only imagine where they would have hit. Iranians don't know exactly where they would have hit. Some are very accurate, some are not. But certainly overhead, Al-Aqsa, the Temple Mount, is quite a big area. I'd be surprised if something wouldn't have hit there had Israel not had any air defense.
We can only imagine what the repercussions of that would have been.
Now, you mentioned that you might have had forewarning. From what we understand, the Iranians told the Turks to pass a message to us 72 hours in advance. The White House is somewhat denying it. But to be honest, the behavior of the White House in the 72 hours before the attack suggested to me they knew, and they did not know from intelligence. The precision with which we said this will be hit, this will not be hit, indicated we were told where Iran will hit. And that's something that is intention, not that there's no technical means you can see that with. And I doubt our human intelligence was so good that we had a perfect vision so I think we were told 72 hours in advance.
All right, David, and what I want to come back to on the other side of a very short break is, what did the U.S. government do in that space of time? And what is it now doing? And what might it do going forward? And indeed, what the Israeli government might have to do despite it all. That and much more with the great David Wormser. Please stay tuned for more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Iran just fired 300 missiles at Israel for various reasons, including concerted defensive efforts by the Jewish state, American forces, and even Jordan. Miraculously, nearly all failed to cause damage. President Biden wants the Israelis to forego retaliation, telling Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. supports Israel, but not any offensive operation against the mullahs. Evidently, having aided Israel's defense, Team Biden now intends to defend Iran. Congressional Republicans finally appear ready to really help Israel. That requires emergency resupply of her greatly depleted arsenal, investigating the Biden administration's foreknowledge of and culpability in this Iranian assault, and standing with Israel as she responds. Clearly, the only hope of preventing the Ayatollahs from doing far worse in the future is to assist the Iranian people in ending the regime that oppresses them and genocidally threatens Israel and us. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy, our great leader on issues involving the Middle East, is with us for this continued, very timely, very important conversation about what Iran unleashed against the Jewish state, ostensibly in retaliation for Israel, we're told, killing not but just one, but seven senior personnel, including some directly involved in plotting the October 7th attack against Israel. But there was nothing proportionate, folks, as David Wormser has just laid out in our previous segment. Some 300 missiles aimed at civilian targets and perhaps even religious sites holy to Muslims, no less, but certainly very sensitive facilities in Israel, as well as places where mass casualties could have been predicted, was not in any way, shape, or form proportionate to anything that the Israelis has done to date towards Iran. But talk to us, David, about, you mentioned that the president may have had 72 hours on the basis of information passed to him through the Turks, forewarning that the Iranians were going to attack. We certainly were hearing the administration's spokesman, including, I think, people out of the intelligence community, indicating that it was coming and it was going to be, you know, an attack via missiles and so on. But what is striking to me, David, unless I missed it, was the president didn't really do much to discourage the Iranians from taking this action. I think the closest he came to it was saying that Iran would not succeed. What did you make of that?
I think you're absolutely right. It also raises the issue of don't, if he knew. And there's a precedent with Ayn al-Assad where we killed Soleimani, which, of course, under the Trump administration, which was a devastating blow to the regime. And we knew that Iran would respond. So we essentially warned the Iranians, you are not to do anything serious. And the Iranians needed to do something, so they essentially forewarned us that they were going to hit our base Ayn al-Assad in Iraq, and they did. But that precedent then led, which is a very limited thing, to a very devastating blow. What that led to, though, was what we saw earlier, about 2-3 months ago, where the United States had three soldiers killed. And we negotiated with Iran a proper response by Iranian militias that we would do that wouldn't trigger a response by Iran. So we literally negotiated how much was acceptable in terms of the back and forth. And I think we did this on the larger level with the Iranians now.
Well, hold the thought, David, just real quick. Do you think that one of the other things that was in that mix in those negotiations was sending them more money? Because we've certainly been doing a lot of that.
I'm certain that there is an element of we won't expand this or do escalatory means. We'll let you get it off your chest. And then we'll try to return back to seeking this JCPOA 2.0, which is a regional strategic condominium with Iran, which implies sanctions and so being lifted and so on and so forth. So I think they thought Iran would do its thing. It would be a limited attack, maybe couple dozen drones, maybe a few missiles here and there. I think the Iranians went beyond what they told us because they smelled weakness. They saw that Israel and the United States were not in the same place. And part of their strategy is to divide the United States and Israel and put Israel in a very weak place. So they launched enough missiles thinking that some will get through. I think they looked at Ukraine and expected between 10 and 20% to get through, which would have been about 70 warheads would have gotten through, which certainly would have killed many Israelis, done severe damage and provided horrible imagery. But the key is the United States essentially negotiated a proper, quote, an appropriate strike by Iran on Israel, on our ally, which is stunning.
Honestly. And is now having, to its credit, provided some defense to Israel in the face of all of this.
Well,
it now seems to be busily trying to defend Iran.
It provided defense because it didn't want Israel wounded enough to force a retaliation. They thought it would be a small strike. Our forces would stop everything. And Israel would be beholden because nothing really even got to the Israeli defenses. And then Israel would
have... But as you said, the lion's share was actually done by the Israelis.
Right. And then the Israelis wouldn't have any reason to strike and we can restrain them. And I think that was part of the understandings with Iran. What happened here was much bigger and more potentially more deadly. It didn't wind up more deadly, and the Israelis did all the lifting. And the Israelis were not part of these understandings to begin with. They need to respond, and there's a very strong strategic imperative for them responding, which we could get into.
Well, lay that out, because I think this is a moment where we need to have a very frank conversation about not only what happens if Israel does not, but also... what kinds of things do you think are appropriate in the circumstances?
Well, yes, I think that, you see, the United States definitely asked Israel to stop. Israel stopped the retaliation en route. I have good sources telling me it was stopped. I do believe the Israelis will still do a strike. The pressures internally are high. And the reason for it is they're looking at the expansion of what they faced in Gaza for the last 20 years, expanding now to the strategic level with Iran. The constant periodic strikes, the constant retaliations for the retaliations against Israel itself, except in Gaza, it led to October 7th, eventually, this back and forth. The basing your strategy entirely on defense and successful defense led to October 7th, the catastrophic failure. Israel is being asked by the United States to return to that concept and base its defense, base its strategy entirely on defense strategically, which will eventually wind up into a nuclear October 7th. So Israel is being asked to return to October 6th, and Israel's saying no. So it needs to strike back. Also, whether this strike was a humiliation and a defeat of Iran or a success depends on Israel's reaction now. If it does not strike back, Iran will spin the narrative that this was only a small taste of what they can do. The big stuff could come, but the Israelis were too scared, too frightened. Like rabbits, they went into their holes and took it. And Nasrallah already last week was saying Israel doesn't exist anymore as an independent country. It is just the tutelage of the United States, an appendage of the United States, and answers, and is constrained by the United States. It's dependent. It's a dependency. So they will make that argument that, you see, Israel would have wanted to do something, but they can't. So it drives home.
And David, of course, as we've been talking about, that's a perception that is already far advanced thanks to what's been going on in Hamas down.
Completely.
And it can only be made infinitely worse. So, David, in a commentary I did this morning, and people, you can subscribe to the Secure Freedom Minute at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. I encourage you to do so. I just said, there are three things. The Republicans in Congress seem to have had enough of this. And I understand that they're now prepared to take on the administration for what it's doing to Israel. I hope they will. One seems to me, if they're going to do something useful, is to insist that there be emergency resupply of Israel. What was done in the way of defenses was spectacular, but obviously is depleted dramatically what they had left in the way of kit, notably Iron Dome. We need, I believe, an investigation of what this administration knew and when it knew it.
Yes.
And what it did as a result of what it knew about what was coming.
Yes.
And we need to stand with Israel as it responds. So we've got 30 seconds. What's your shortest of short forms on what Israel should do now?
I think Israel should administer a devastating blow that hits regime symbols, as well as obviously factories that produce this equipment, launch sites, and a nuclear program. This is the time to get the job done. But more than anything, Israel has been dealing for 40 years with the with fires all over the region. They're getting sick of it. They need to deal with the arsonist. This now is an Israeli-Iranian fight. They must win this fight and deal with the arsonist.
And we must help them liberate Iran from this horrible regime that threatens them, of course, as well as us. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon, David, with updates. I hope you all will stay tuned for more from a woman who just visited Israel for 15 days to report on what's happening there, Cheryl Chumley.
After night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and what a delight to be able to welcome our next guest. She's one of my favorites. Her name is Cheryl Chumley. She is the online editor and a columnist for The Washington Times, one of the papers of record for me, I think, and for most of those of us who are sensible about national security and so much more here in the Washington area, especially. Cheryl is an author as well of a number of really important books, including Lockdown, The Socialist Plan to Take Away Your Freedom, and a topic that is particularly relevant to today's conversation with her. Socialists don't sleep. Christians must rise or America will fall. Cheryl, it's great to have you back. I so look forward to these conversations, and especially in light of what we've just been talking about with Dr. David Wormser, to get your insights from a trip that I understand you've just returned from to the Holy Land, to Israel, to report on what is going on there in this war, which has now, of course, been transformed by the attacks for the first time since the mullahs came to power, directly from Iranian soil against the Jewish state. Give us your thoughts as to what is afoot here and whether, as a person who is profoundly aware of and thoughtful about Christians and their role and the spiritual warfare, which I think is really now being made manifest all over the world, how does that tie into what you saw in Israel just recently?
Right. Well, first off, great to be with you again, Frank. I always love being on your show. And second off, that is the question, right? The battle of principalities and how that's playing out in the day to day. And as you mentioned, I just returned from a 15-day trip to Israel where I covered war-related issues for the Washington Times. And part of the reason I wanted to go there was because of the changing narrative. Very quickly after October 7th, we saw in the media and in politics around the world that the poor Israeli people had been replaced by the poor Palestinian people. And now with the attack on Iran, we are seeing the latest step away from support for Israel in that changing narrative. And what's really concerning is that this White House is trying to sort of hogtie Israel's ability to defend itself, and in so doing, only emboldening these evil forces more. So if you're a Christian looking at what's taking place against Israel right now, you really need to, at the same time, be looking through your Bible and seeing how what is promised in terms of prophecy in the Bible is playing out on the ground, because we are actually living these final times. Nobody knows the end date on it, right? But we do know that one of the key actions that had to take place for end times was the establishment of the Jewish nation, and then the turning of the world against Israel. And that is a concern that all Americans ought to be looking at right now, Joe Biden's actions against Israel.
You know, we had Reverend Kevin Jessup on last week, and he was talking about some of these prophesied end times evidences. And it's a chilling thought. As you say, we don't know how imminent it all is. But on the other hand, we know that it comes out right in the end, but there is a lot of rough country between here and there, that's for sure. And I just wanted to come back to this incredibly important insight. You say that it's kind of odd a turn of phrase for people who eschew pigs, but hogtied is indeed what this administration is doing to the people of Israel and their government at best. And I'm sure you saw it on the ground, and I'd love your insights into this, Cheryl. The degree to which an ally, arguably the most important ally, certainly in that part of the world, of this country, is being treated as though it is somehow at best kind of a vassal state, and at worst, someone who is to be torn down. Not just Benjamin Netanyahu, the democratically elected prime minister of the state of Israel, but, you know, the state itself. What are your thoughts on that, as you've seen what they've been doing, both with respect to Hamas, saving Hamas, really, and undermining Israel's efforts to destroy it in Gaza, but now with this latest business of saying to the Israelis, well, we're going to defend you, but we're not going to support you if you decide you're going to act offensively in retaliation for what Iran has just done?
So first off, the Israeli people pay very close attention to politics from America. I mean, even the taxi drivers know more than I think know more than the average American citizen about the behind scenes discussions and how in the White House, how policy and narratives play out around the world. So the Israeli people are very aware of the differences between this administration and the last Donald Trump administration. And by all accounts, everyone I spoke to, they said this: Israel feels very alone right now. And they're not worried so much about Israel as they are about America, and rightly so, right? Because Genesis tells us that those who bless Israel, God will bless; those who curse Israel, God will curse. And so look at what America is doing under Joe Biden right now. You can't say you support a country and then turn around and by action do everything to not support the country. And that's exactly what this White House has been doing.
I couldn't agree more, Cheryl. And it's shocking, really. As well as, I think, strategically, of the worst, you know, kind of malfeasance. But talk a little bit about, speaking of politics, talk about how what the administration is doing, obviously out of some conviction that Benjamin Netanyahu is the single impediment to the realization of their delusional Palestinian state, that they're going to overthrow him. They're going to actually kind of have a color revolution, I think some people are calling it, with the direct intervention of William Burns, the director of Central Intelligence, to accomplish this. What do the people of Israel make of that? I mean, it's not just that they're alone, it's that they're being attacked by their ally.
Well, I can tell you that I visited the Nova Festival site, and I saw the makeshift memorial that was set up for those who were slaughtered and
this is where the peace concert was being held in the area near Gaza.
This is the site where Hamas first struck, where they first entered, and all the youth there, right? There were thousands there attending a music festival. They all scattered. Yeah,
a peace concert. No less on October
7th. Right. And this was the point that I wanted to make by bringing this up, that most of the youth who attended that concert were of the more progressive mindset that thought if they only befriended Palestinians and offered them help and assistance, medical aid and food and job opportunities, that the Palestinians would likewise be their friends. And they were the ones who had their eyes so dramatically and wickedly open to the reality of evil, right? You can't do a diplomatic dance with evil. You can't. The only thing that evil understands is strength. And this administration, like those poor victims in Israel who thought that by talking and persuading and befriending evil, they might do some good. This administration is only exasperating the situation, making it worse, emboldening more evil, which we are seeing. First Hamas, then Hezbollah, right? And now we see Iran directly attacking. And we have this administration telling Israel, do not retaliate against Iran, which only emboldens evil more.
Unquestionably. And again, I think coming back to the spiritual warfare dimension of this is so important. And when you talk about the eyes being opened, you know, one of my favorite expressions is that conservatives are liberals who've been mugged by reality. And I think those progressives, and it wasn't just the people at the concert, as you know, Cheryl, many in those kibbutz operations adjacent to the Gaza Strip, or people who had employed, in many cases, Palestinians and were trying to lift them up as well as, you know, help improve their quality of lives, and who were, you know, bringing their children into Israel for medical treatment and all this stuff. And they were ruthlessly murdered, tortured, raped, in some cases taken hostage by people who used information intelligence that had been garnered in that process. So what the point of all of this was to say, Benjamin Netanyahu obviously is, shall we say, viewed with disfavor by a lot of Israelis. I'm not making that case, but it does seem as though, for the reasons you've mentioned among others, Israelis across the political spectrum support the policies that he's pursuing and will not change from those policies no matter who's going to be their next leader. Is that your view?
It is true. It's interesting because the parallel to America is this. In the days after September 11th, we saw Democrats and Republicans standing on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, linking arms and pledging to go after the evil, right? That didn't last long. Pretty soon it was Democrats who stepped away and started up with their anti-America rhetoric again. But in Israel, no matter what the politics are of the individual, they all agree that the two-state solution was dead on October 7th, and that Benjamin Netanyahu's pledge to eradicate the terrorists is the rightful path to take.
This is the perfect point on which to close with you. Thank you, my dear. This is so helpful. Thank you for your investigative reporting from Israel, as well as the great work you do with the Washington Times online editorial page.
Thank you.
God bless you. keep it up. Come back to us soon if you would. We'll be right back with more about the World Health Organization. Reggie Littlejohn, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Iran just fired 300 missiles at Israel for various reasons, including concerted defensive efforts by the Jewish state, American forces, and even Jordan. Miraculously, nearly all failed to cause damage. President Biden wants the Israelis to forego retaliation, telling Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. supports Israel, but not any offensive operation against the mullahs. Evidently, having aided Israel's defense, Team Biden now intends to defend Iran. Congressional Republicans finally appear ready to really help Israel. That requires emergency resupply of her greatly depleted arsenal, investigating the Biden administration's foreknowledge of and culpability in this Iranian assault, and standing with Israel as she responds. Clearly, the only hope of preventing the Ayatollahs from doing far worse in the future is to assist the Iranian people in ending the regime that oppresses them and genocidally threatens Israel and us. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We have another of my favorite guests with us. Her name is Reggie Littlejohn. We partner up on all manner of things very important, drawing upon her incredible expertise as a Yale-trained litigator and attorney who has now turned her attention to, among other things, human rights, notably the work that she is about in the organization that she founded and leads called Women's Rights Without Frontiers. But in her spare time, she's also slaying some other dragons, including with our partnership at the Sovereignty Coalition and the Stop Vaccine Passports Task Force, and its sponsor, the Committee on the Present Danger of China, all of which she's an important part of, trying to keep the nation free and our sovereignty intact and our medical and personal freedoms the guaranteed level that our Constitution has provided for. Reggie, I thank you for all of that work. It is a privilege to be able to partner with you on it, and I'm so glad to have a chance to talk with you a little bit about particularly this effort that we're making on the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the impending surrender of our sovereignty to it by the Biden administration. So first, welcome. And second, tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Thank you so very much, Frank. It's great to be here. So at the end of May, very shortly from now, the World Health Organization is scheduled to be voting on two instruments, the amendments to the international health regulations and the new pandemic treaty. And taken together, these two instruments will issue in a global or globalist biotech surveillance police state in which we will lose our national sovereignty and our personal medical freedom. And the way that that works is that the World Health Organization wants to change itself from being an advisory body to being like a regulatory body with powers of enforcement. And one of the things they want to be able to do is to tell countries like our country, the other 194 nations in the World Health Organizations, how to handle any public health emergency of international concern, which is that will be dictated by Tedros Ghebreyesus, the Director General. Right, yeah. And so who is?
Let me just ask you on this question though, Reggie, because it's important. I think you say the World Health Organization wants to do this, but there are actually forces at work somewhat behind the scenes. As most of this is behind the scenes, actually. They're not allowing us to see what's being negotiated along these lines. Tell us about some of those forces, if you would.
Well, behind the World Health Organization is the United Nations, which has its own platform that they're going to be floating, in September. So to do an emergency authorization, being able to take over through that. But also I think that the forces behind the World Health Organization are represented by their funders. So for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi, a lot of big pharma, so that we're in a situation
where the Chinese Communist Party and the World Economic Forum and the European Union and, you know, people who have agendas,
Right. And one of the main
agendas, administration too.
Right. So one of the main agendas through big pharma is to make money, right? And the way that they make money is by having, you know, forcing vaccines or, you know, providing them. But the World Health Organization wants the power to have mandatory vaccines. Mask mandates, quarantines, lockdowns, and this is a direct.
This sounds vaguely familiar. Is this something that we've actually seen before? This movie sounds a lot like the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic. You're not just speculating as to where this would go. You're drawing on hard experience, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, we saw that Big Pharma had a huge influence on the way that the World Health Organization handled the pandemic. And there is an interview of Bill Gates at the World Economic Forum where he admits, I mean, he's actually boasting that the return on investment for vaccines is 20-1. So he invested $10 billion, and so he made $19 billion off of the vaccines in COVID-19. And he put in about 10% of the world's funding of that. So the entire world, the big pharma made about $190 billion off of the COVID vaccine. So that's why they have the money to basically buy off anyone that they want.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're not buying us off, that's for sure. And I want to just say a word or two about some of the people that are involved on our side, as Steve Bannon likes to say, of the football. Of course, our Sovereignty Coalition, Reggie, which Women's Rights Without Frontiers and our Center for Security Policy have partnered to pull together this amazing team of people. I mean, just unbelievably formidable. And we have vehicles at sovereigntycoalition.org, which you can find among other ways through centerforsecuritypolicy.org, to fight against what's afoot here. And we're going to talk after a short break in a moment about what specifically we're trying to do. But Reggie, just a word about the kinds of things that, in addition to this unbelievable, unprecedented concentration of power in Tedros Ghebreyesus that we're raising the alarm at, sovereigntycoalition.org about, and one that you've really helped frame, I think, brilliantly in terms of the digital gulag. Just talk a little bit about that and how this fits into the larger agenda specifically of the Chinese Communist Party.
So the Chinese Communist Party, they have a social credit system, which they enforce through AI and digital IDs, artificial intelligence and digital IDs, which are coming or are here. They're being rolled out by the World Health Organization in conjunction with the European Union. They're being rolled out worldwide. And what these will do is they will track every single aspect of our lives. And they can control us because they are connected to our bank accounts, our credit cards, our medical care, our ability to get government benefits, our ability to vote, our ability to pay our taxes, to travel. All of that is going to be centered on this digital ID. So that if we step out of line, like, for example, if we decide that we are not going to get vaccinated or get boosted, or if we post criticisms of the government, like you and I are doing right now, then we can be shut off from our ability to participate in society.
All right. So hold this thought, Reggie. This is a perfect point to turn to. What are we going to do about this to prevent it from happening, perhaps as soon as the end of May, some 42 days or so from now, and what you can do to help make sure that we do derail these votes on the treaties the WHO seeks to inflict upon us. Stay tuned for more right after this. Welcome back, Reggie. Little John is in the house. I'm always delighted to be able to say that. The president and founder of Women's Rights Without Frontiers and the co-leader of our sovereigntycoalition.org. Reggie, we've been talking about the efforts being made come the end of May to inflict what they call global governance on us. I think you've made the case pretty powerfully that if you actually like our form of government, checks and balances, you know, monarch or dictator, the idea that our freedoms are actually guaranteed by a constitution, global governance is not going to be for you. And yet it's coming at you at warp speed, if I can use that expression. When you look at this World Health Assembly meeting that's supposed to take place at the end of May, what are they going to be addressing? And what, as things stand now, all of the things being equal, is likely to come out of it?
Well, at the World Health Assembly from May 27th to June 2nd, and by the way, Frank, I am planning to be there in Geneva for that. I will be able to report from on the ground in Geneva. But so what they're planning to do and what the Biden administration and the World Health Organization are trying to ram through is voting on these two instruments, the new pandemic treaty and the amendments to the international health regulations. And I believe that they are desperate to ram these through in May because that is under the Biden administration. And they are concerned that if they wait until the following World Health Assembly, that there will be a different administration who will be significantly less amenable to their aims. Possibly even Donald Trump, who has in the past withdrawn us from the World Health Assembly. They don't want to deal with that again. So they're trying to ram this through. And I want to say this, Frank, that according to the rules of the in the international health regulations, there's something called Article 55, which requires all amendments to the international health regulation, the full text of them, to be disclosed to the nations 4 months in advance of a vote. That deadline passed on January 27th, and we still have not seen the final drafts. I've heard that they're actually having trouble negotiating with these out, but it's possible that they could just spring it on the world like the weekend before or a couple weeks before. And what that does is it makes it impossible for the world to analyze the impact of this and for civil society to have any kind of comment in it. So I have been saying, right, exactly.
No, I was just saying, I call this the Nancy Pelosi rule. You'll know what's in it after you vote for it, right? So, Reggie, here's the thing. You're a trained attorney. There are those who say, well, actually, they've got some rationale for saying, well, we don't need to provide this advance notice because these amendments have been kicking around for a while. You also know that the administration, Joe Biden, is not intent on treating the international health regulations accord, to say nothing of the pandemic accord, as treaties, which they both are, according, among others, to the Congressional Research Service. So how does this work? I mean, what's going to happen if, for example, they violate their own regulations and there is no check and balance on these foreign treaties in the United States Senate?
Frank, the answer to that question depends, I believe, just about 100% on what kind of action people are willing to take. Okay, these people are lawless. And as people know from the Bible, it says, in the end times, lawlessness will abound. They know what they want, and they're just going to get it. And they don't care what the laws are. They don't care what rules they break. So what we have to do is raise the visibility of this issue so that there is an outcry and a demand that this not happen. Because if we don't do that, they will simply do it like they've done other things in the past that were unconstitutional.
So we have a campaign, which I'm pleased to announce here, I think for the first time, will be among the things discussed at a very important press conference. We were hoping to do it last week. It just didn't materialize, but it's happening on the 18th of April. At 9 a.m. at a location called the House Triangle near the Capitol. And we will have members of Congress. We will have at least one United States senator. We will have leaders of our conservative movement and other patriots who will come together to talk about, among other things, Reggie, the campaign to do just what you talked about, the emergency campaign, I call it, not no way campaign. Not now campaign that will be aimed at trying to prevent this this train wreck from happening in Geneva.
Right. And, so this is the reason.
Or thereabouts. Go ahead.
Right. So this is the reason I've been pushing this strategy of delay, because you know you and I, Frank, and many of your viewers know that this is a terrible thing, that there is going to be a digital gulag, we're going to lose our medical freedom, all kinds of terrible things are going to happen. But we have not had time to inform enough people about this. So instead of getting people to just say, vote no on it, we're getting people to say, not now. In other words, we need to delay this. They're breaking their own rules. And what will happen if we are able to get a delay is that we will have the time then, more time to have conversations like this and get the word out about what's going on and why this thing needs to be defeated entirely.
There is an Align Act campaign that we invite our listeners to subscribe to enroll in, if you will, at sovereigntycoalition.org. This is a really important call out. This may be one of the most important action items you're ever going to be offered, frankly, because what Reggie has just described to a fairly well, really, is the prospective end of America as we have known and loved her. We will have a dictator. And while one might say, well, it's just health, he says everything is health. And he will have under these treaties, and they're kind of a belt and suspenders approach is the way I call it, Reggie. Both of them are bad. Individually, they would be bad. Both of them are treaties. Both of them need to be rejected by the United States Senate. You can let your senators and House representatives, and for that matter, your president know you don't want any part of the World Health Organization global governance gambit. Go to sovereigntycoalition.org to make that plain. Both, as I say, to the president and your other representatives, we need your help, folks. Sovereigntycoalition.org. Do it today. There's no time to waste. Reggie Littlejohn, thank you for your great leadership in all of this. We'll look forward to seeing you on the 9th, the 9 o'clock on the 18th of April. In the meantime, Godspeed. Thanks. Look forward to talking to the rest of you next time as well. Until then, go forth and multiply.